I love Christmas. It's just what a joyous time and gives life so much meaning and purpose. I'm not a pulpit kind of guy. I'm too gregarious. I'd like to be closer to you. I'm not a pastor. I'm not a theologian. I'm an ex-felon. Went to prison. You'll hear about that this morning. How many of you have heard me speak before? Raise your hand so I know. Okay, so most have not. Most have not. My qualifications as a speaker, okay? In high school, I graduated at the very top of the lower third of my class. I have ADHD DE, Hyperattention Deficit Disorder Deluxe Edition, okay? For 5.5 years, I got to be the chief diver for Jacques Cousteau. What an amazing opportunity. For 5.5 years, I got to lead their expeditions diving with whales and dolphins and sharks. And then I became a Seventh-day Adventist, and I quit my job. And my father-in-law, Walter Barber, anybody here know Pastor Walter Barber? Elder Barber? Walter Barber? Anybody? One over there? Just one? He was concerned, and he called me to his front room, and he said, sit down. He said, I want to know what you're going to do to support my daughter after you've been to all the Seventh-day Adventist churches and you told your story of redemption. What are you going to do to support my daughter? And I said, Walt, without hesitation, if God wants me speaking in his house, he'll give me what to say. And I have some very big shoes to fill. You see, Walter Barber passed away 2 months ago. 90 years old, going on 91. He passed away in the front room of the house next door. When I married my wife Cindy and we moved to Paradise, I wanted to buy the house next door to Grandma and Grandpa. Cindy at first didn't want to do that because Grandma always tells Cindy what to do, her mom, and she still does. You know, here she is 50 years, I didn't say that. She goes to church and Grandma always checks out her clothes and says, well, you know, maybe this, tweak that, tweak this. But I knew the best thing that I could possibly do for my children and for Cindy and I was to live next door to Grandma and Grandpa. And Walt, when he passed away, my son and I were to be two of the pallbearers. Now, something you need to know about me, I'm an adventure guy, and I have never owned a suit. My son has owned a couple of suits. So since he had some experience with suits, he and I went down to buy suits to be pallbearers for Grandpa. And I said, well, what kind of suits do we get, Chase? And he said, well, Dad, it's got to be all black, because this is for Grandpa. And as I go around and speak now, I wear a suit, because I have some big shoes to try to fill, because Grandpa did a lot of really good things. And it's affected what it is that I have to talk about with you this morning. You see, for every church I speak in 3 to 4 public schools. I'm all over the United States. I've spoken to over 1,700 public schools in 49 states and in 6 countries. Now, when I speak in the public schools, there's 2 words that I'm supposedly not allowed to say. I'm not allowed to talk about Jesus Christ. Now, often in elementary schools, I'll see the Ten Commandments of Nature. And it's a beautiful poster. It always gets kids' attention. Very well displayed. And the very first commandment is love your mother earth. You can have that, but you can't talk about Jesus Christ. The most important thing that I have to talk to kids about, I'm not allowed to say. So what I do, when I speak in a public school, I try to do this. I say, hey, if you like the program I've done here at the school, I'm going to be at the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the English Oak Seventh-day Adventist Church, at Saturday night at 4 p.m. sharp. And it's a family program, and if you want, you can bring your, you know, brothers and sisters, and it's all free. And then I'll ask them, okay, where am I going to be? And they'll, somebody, a kid will always shout it out, you're going to be at the English Oak Seventh-day Adventist Church. Now, did a little seed get planted? Okay. Bottom line is, young people in public schools don't know about Jesus Christ. They don't know the Ten Commandments. They don't know that he's such a loving God, because there's so much propaganda out there working against our, you know, what we want to share, the love. Now, what I'm used to is I'm used to coming into a Seventh-day Adventist church, and when I see a public school right across the street, I usually ask the congregation who's involved over at the public school. And you know what kind of an answer I usually get? They're not involved at the public school. Except I had a surprise this morning, Because I asked your associate pastor, and where are you at? Where are you at? What do you got going on over at the, okay, pastor, what do you got going on over at the high school? Christian club, they all know about it. This is really neat stuff. This is important. This is so valuable, it's incredible. You see, I'm at war. The program is called Building a Christian Warrior. It used to be when I first started doing this sermon about building a Christian warrior, I told you how I became a Christian warrior. And I'm going to show you a video on that in a minute. But the bottom line, this is about you being that Christian warrior because we're at war. You know, when you look outside, does it look like a war zone? Isn't it pretty out there? Doesn't look like a war zone. But you know what? The number one killer of teenagers in America is accidents. But number two is suicide. Number three is murder, usually by who? Usually by another kid. Okay, I'm going to ask, you want to see the video first before I start getting really heavy on you? Let me show you this video. If you're ready, please hit play. This is my story in 3.5 minutes by NBC. Isn't that it backed up a little bit. How'd that happen? There it is.
10 feet down in the blue water of the South Pacific, Steve Arrington is that close to disaster. And he's as happy as a man can be. Eye to eye with a great white shark, he's a man redeemed.
I'm a very lucky person. What I've been through, I've experienced something a lot of people don't get the chance to do. And because I've seen the shadow side of the world, it makes me appreciate the light that's out there.
Once upon a time, Steve Arrington was a young Navy golden boy, a frogman, a bomb disposal expert, officer material. Then one day he was caught selling marijuana, and he was out of the Navy and on the beach, and fell into the drug business. Was drawn like a fly to the web, found himself running cocaine for the Medellin cartel. He was faced with a choice, drive the car with the coke inside or die. And so began his brief brush with notoriety. Is a footnote in a worldwide publicity frenzy.
The conspiracy was allegedly hatched between the auto tycoon and two other men.
Arrington was arrested in Los Angeles by agents closing in on the John DeLorean case.
A man leaped out of the darkness as he opens the door, and he jams a .38 special alongside my head, and he told me, move and die. And I thought it was a ripoff, and I thought I was about to die. And the next words that he said were the greatest words I've ever heard in my life. He said, DEA, federal agent, you're under arrest. Suddenly, I felt a burden had been lifted from my shoulders. I wasn't arrested, I was saved.
He was sentenced to 5 years in a federal penitentiary. Arrington's life had hit bottom.
You live in a cell like this. The cell is from here to here. You can stretch your arms out and touch both walls. I knew that I had to live with this. And I had a goal. I wanted to do things like this.
But inside, he made himself a promise that no kid would ever come to a place like this if Arrington could prevent it. And now, with missionary zeal, he talks to students, scouts, anybody who will listen about the ugly world on the wrong side of the law.
Prison is about fear. Everybody's afraid. The really big, gnarly, bad-looking dude, he's afraid. And people get murdered. You know, they don't need a reason for somebody to kill you in prison. Somebody can have you killed for 2 cartons of cigarettes in prison. 2 cartons of cigarettes, value of somebody's life in prison.
Did they listen? Yes, enthralled.
Was it easy starting it over?
Okay, was it easy starting my life over? Very good question. I walk up, or somebody's gonna hire me, let's say, and I walk up and I say, I'm an ex-felon. Do they wanna hire me? Do you wanna have me living next door? Do you want me dating your sister? Yes or no? No, it's a definite no.
Until he asked the Cousteau Society, which decided that an old Navy frogman who had seen the worst of man would be perfect to study the world of sharks. This month he is in the South Pacific, staring down jaws and, as we say, redeemed.
I call this slide freedom. This is the type of things I thought about for my jail cell.
Keith Morrison, NBC News, Los Angeles.
And pause, please, Steve. Was that a cool shark? Hey, I have to tell you something really quick before we get too heavy. I'm going to be back at 4 o'clock. Okay, I'm going to share whales and dolphins and sharks. I'm going to prove tonight that my being a lay youth minister in the Seventh-day Adventist Church has been a bigger adventure than being chief diver for Jacques Cousteau. I'm going to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that my being a lay youth minister, a lay person, okay, in this church has been a bigger adventure than being chief diver for Jacques Cousteau. I once was on the back of the Cousteau boat, and I jumped into the water and landed 6 feet from a 17 and a half foot long great white shark. Then I set the world speed record for swimming 6 feet underwater with flippers, and I got inside the world's first all-plastic shark cage. It was a cylinder, it was curved, and as a shark came up and is biting it, trying to remove my head, I could lean forward and look down her throat. I have that on film. How do you like the stuff you saw in Fiji? Isn't that beautiful? Wait till you hear. Wait till you hear the miracles that are going on in Fiji. You know, you may have been wanting to bring a friend, somebody, into this church, and you want to bring them into a program that you want them to have a really good time. You want them to be spiritually touched. You want them not to be bored. I mean, to make sure that this is something that's really going to touch them so that you can lure them in here again. That's my job this evening. I want you to know, at 4 o'clock sharp, I'm going to be doing a program. It's not going to be preachy. It's for the whole family, whales and dolphins and sharks. I'll be showing with Fiji. But my job is to reinforce why people need to be here and to introduce them, to help introduce them to what this church is all about. But if you want to know how I became a Seventh-day Adventist, you have to be here at 3:55. Because at 3:55, I'm going to share how I became a Seventh-day Adventist. Okay? Now, I'm going to get a little heavy on you this morning, and I'm going to go a little bit longer than I prefer to go, but we're at war, and kids are on the front lines, and there's things that are really important that we need to talk about. Now, I'm going to ask you some questions. The faster you answer the question, the faster we get out. Okay? All right? At the academy here in Lodi, what percentage of the kids who go to the academy graduate? 100%? 83%? Where'd you get 83? I don't know. It's 90. According to the conference, according to the division in North America, kids who attend the academy, 95% graduate on average. What percent go on to college? 80%, 85. 85% go on to college. What percent of kids who go to public school graduate? 50, depending on region, is anywhere from 30 to 40% drop out. Some places 50% drop out. Usually 30% have dropped out by the 10th grade. What percentage of the kids who go to public school go on to college? 16%. You know, that's the exact opposite of at the academies. Do you know that 40% of the children born in America today are born into a single-parent household? 40% are born into a single-parent household, and at some point in time, up to 82% of the children in America will wind up in a single-parent household for part of their childhood. 82%? This is pretty scary stuff. The number one killer of teenagers in America is accidents. Number two is suicide. Number three is murder. I'm going to ask you a really heavy question. This is the only question that you don't answer right away. The question that I'm going to ask, if you know the answer, I want you to raise your hand. But don't raise your hand unless you're 100% sure you're right. You can't guess. You have to absolutely know the answer to this question, or don't raise your hand. I want to know what the age of consent is in the state of California. I mean, what age can an adult have a legal, illicit, isn't that a combination of words? A legal, illicit relationship with a young person, a child. What is the age of consent in California? If you're 100% sure of your answer, raise your hand right now. We got one? Oh, it's a kid who raised his hand. I got one. Okay, what is it? How do you know that? Good. Is your dad here? Is your dad here? Oh, what a smart young man. Now, how many of you knew it was 18? Or how many of you think it was 18? Okay, see, you knew. Here's my point. A pedophile always knows what the age of consent is where they're at, because they're hunting. They're hunting children. Our children. Matthew 18:6, if you have someone who's putting a stumbling block in the path of a child, what should happen to that person according to Christ? A millstone around the neck and drown in the depths of the ocean. That's Jesus Christ. That's how he feels about protecting children. Our children are under attack. You see, at the end times, and I think we stepped across the threshold, the Bible, the Word of God, the family unit, our church is all supposed to be under attack. Hey, guess what? We're under attack. It's a war. Do you know that more children are committing suicide every day than the veterans who are killed in the Middle East who are fighting a war? We're losing more kids who are shooting and killing each other than all the veterans killed every day in Iraq. We got a war going on, and you and I are on the front lines. We are on the front lines. It's here, it's now. It's a part of it. Hey, what is the fastest growing rate of crime for a time frame in California? What is the fastest growing crime rate in California for a time frame? What is the time frame? 3 to 6 p.m. Why 3 to 6 p.m.? Parents don't work, kids are out of school. If a kid drops out of school, who's mentoring them? Oh, yes, there's somebody mentoring them. What does a gang say to a young person that they will be if they'll join the gang? Family. I do prison ministry. I remember a lay minister like me, a great big he was a Chicano American, great big guy. He'd been a gang member, he started a gang. And then he went to prison. And in prison he gave his life to Christ and Christ turned his life around. And I asked him, I said, why did you join a gang in the first place? And he was bigger than you, okay? And he looked at me in tears. I mean, he's in his 50s now. Tears start to flow down his eyes. The emotions are so huge. He said, because they loved me. I joined the gang because they loved me. When I was a kid growing up, I was terrified of my father. He was a child abuser. Finally, my mom divorced him and threw him out. That was the best thing that could have happened. But I wanted a father in my life. I loved my grandparents. They lived over 200 miles away. How often did I get to see them? I basically raised myself. I wanted to do good things. I joined the military. I became a bomb disposal frogman. I went to Vietnam. I did 4 tours. I never hurt anybody. I just wanted to do good things. I had friends who were using marijuana, and because my friends were making a mistake, I started making a mistake. You know what? If I had a father who loved me and grandparents who were there, maybe that wouldn't have happened. Maybe I wouldn't have had to go to prison. But the fact that I went to prison was my fault. When I mention, the reason why I asked you what the age of consent is in California, I was in Colorado, and I asked this question. I asked them what the age of consent was. And they said 18, 16, 15, 14. Finally, somebody hit it, 17. Let me tell you the exact age of consent law for Colorado. The age of consent in Colorado is an unfettered 17. Should be a period. Instead, there's a comma. It then goes on to say, however, there exists in legislation close in age exceptions in that if the child is between the ages of 15 and 17 and they are less than 10 years younger than the actor, notice I didn't say perpetrator, than the actor, or if the child is under 15 and the actor is less than 5 years older, it is an exception to the age of consent. Now what that means is that a 27-year-old adult can legally go after a 17-year-old child. It means that if the child is 15 years old, the adult can be 25. If the child is 14 years old, then the adult can be 19 years old. That law is meant to protect who? The perpetrator, who they call the actor. Colorado has the greatest close in age exception in the nation. What is the close in age exception for California? Does anybody know? Five. Okay. There are some considerations that are involved in this. I bring this forward because our children are under attack. What is the fastest growing rate of suicide in the United States for a specific age group. What is the age group? The fastest growing rate of suicide per capita for a specific age group is children between the ages of 10 and 14. This is particularly true of girls. Particularly true for girls. Our children are under attack. And you know what? We are mandated by Christ to protect them. I'm going to give you a Bible verse. Don't open your Bibles. Just finish the verse for me. I'm talking about Matthew 18:12. If you have 100 sheep and one goes missing, what are you supposed to do? Look for it. Look for it. Everybody agreed? If 100 sheep, one goes missing, you look for it. Excuse me, we're leaving something out. Crack a Bible if you have to. If you have 100 sheep, one goes missing, you are to leave the 99 and go find the one that's missing. We're not missing one. We're missing dozens upon dozens of children. They're dropping out of schools. What is the fastest growing rate of incarceration in the state of California today per capita? Teenage. Somebody finish it. The fastest growing rate of incarceration in the state of California today is teenage girls. Girls. Fastest growing rate of incarceration in the state of California today. We are locking up girls like you can't believe. When I used to speak in California lockups 15 years ago, I'd see 5% girls, 95% boys. I'm now seeing 25 to 30% girls. And there's something else. Is their violence rate is higher than the boys. The violence rate in the girls' lockup is higher than the boys. In the men's lockup, 10% of the men incarcerated regularly get visitors. You know what it is in the women's lockup? Only 2 to 3% of the women locked up get visitors. Only 2 to 3%. For the children, they don't give us the statistics, but I happen to know it's a minority. And one of the reasons we lock up youth is for family problems. Family problems. You know, we lock up youth for that. We have to charge them with something. We don't always want to ruin their lives. Do you know how much it costs to lock up a youth in the state of California? If the county locks up a young person, if the county does it, Sacramento County, down in here and all that, it costs around $40-something to $50,000 a year to lock up one youth. How many kids could we send to Pacific Union College for $50,000? Please say two, because I have three. Okay? You know, what does a kid learn when they get locked up? 75% of the children locked up by the state of California are reincarcerated within 3 years. 75% is higher than the adult reincarceration rate. 75% are reincarcerated within 3 years. You know how much it costs if the state locks the young person up? Not the county, but they are moved into a state facility. Do you know how much it costs? $252,000 a year. You want to know why there's such a huge disparity? Because we have six aging, oversized youth authority lockups. They're overstaffed, and they have to have teachers and everything else. $252,000 a year. And what is the result when they graduate from the lockup? Within 3 years, they're back. Are we doing something wrong? Do you know how much California spends on incarceration? You know how much we're spending? In 2006, I have a documentary coming out in 2 weeks on this. In 2006, we spent $6.5 billion, and we were a half billion over budget. We were a half billion short. At that point, we were spending four times more on incarceration than higher education. And the state of California in 2006 spent more money on incarceration than the countries of France, Germany, the Netherlands, and Japan combined. Just California. In 2007, we raised the Department of Corrections to $8.5 billion, and we raised $6.5 billion more to add 53,000 more prison beds. And then last year, we increased the budget to $9.8 billion. It's a 52% increase. And now we're in federal receivership to spend $8 billion more to upgrade the health services in the California Department of Corrections. You hear how big these numbers are? What's it costing us? It's costing us more than money. You know, one of the big things that I've been asked by senior citizens is, what can I do? Okay? What can I do? Boy, I think I have a pretty interesting answer, all right? First of all, we always pray, right? Let the Lord lead. Always pray. Kids need grandparents. When you watch the movies today and the television series, what are the grandparents like in the movies that we see? They're living in a retirement community and rather exotic and trying to look young, and they're kind of strange, and it's not like the sage wisdom that grandmother and grandfathers have. Knowing that the women's lockups only get 2-3% visitors, and that the children get a minority. You know, as a senior citizen, if you go to a public school and you try to talk to a kid walking by, they may not listen to you. But if that person is locked up, if they feel abandoned by their family, and they feel that society is against them, they are desperately looking for answers. And when somebody comes in with sage wisdom, you can change a life. You can change a life. And how do we do it? We get together. Adventists do great things when we get together. The Bible tells us, get together, do this work together. When we get together, get somebody to drive the car. Go into the lockups. Now, when I say this, be careful, because there are people who are incarcerated who will try to take advantage of you. So go in there with wisdom and with good sense. But we need to get involved. And grandma and grandpa, get involved with your grandchildren, because they need it. I know that if my grandparents had been involved, now, something that's happened in my life, and this is where all this is coming from. I live next door to grandma and grandpa. Grandpa passed away. You know, I didn't have any experience on how to be a good father. I didn't have it. I didn't get it from my dad. And so I got it from grandpa. I learned how to be a good father from grandpa and grandma. And I'm still learning. And now that grandpa has passed away, now that grandpa's passed away, grandma's next door. And who does she really need? She needs us. And so she comes over every night for dinner. Grandma's over with us having dinner. And every night when she leaves, she gets to take a kid. One of my daughters goes over and sleeps with grandma, you know, to be with her. And my kids love it. I am watching our children grow up, and you know what? I'm not bragging, but we have great kids. My oldest daughter, she's 16. I said, come on, honey, let's go get you a driver's license. She says, Dad, I don't want to drive. I said, come on. I said, do me a favor. Let's get the driver's license, and then you don't have to drive anymore. She says, well, that doesn't make sense. I said, of course it does, because if you get the license and you stop driving when you are ready to drive, you're going to have a perfect record. So we went down and we got her driver's license. She has a perfect record. Okay? The bottom line is, you know what? It's hard to be good mom or dad by ourselves. It's hard to be mom when dad's not there. And you want to know something that's a growing statistic? It's hard to be dad when mom isn't there. And over 3 million children right now are being raised by their grandparents because neither mom or dad are there. We live in very troubling times. But I believe something that's important is that troubling times are an opportunity to do His work. It's an opportunity. Is there a police officer or a court clerk in the room? A police officer or an attorney or a court clerk? I was really hoping your father would be. Okay, I'm going to ask you a question. Ladies, mothers, first I need your help. There's a hypothetical girl, okay? This hypothetical girl is 17 years old, and she wants to date a boy. And mom is highly suspicious of this boy. And so mom finally says it. She says, you know what? I don't like this boy. I don't trust him. I think he's probably even doing drugs. So I'm going to put my foot down. You will not date him. And that's final. Okay, moms, what's the girl likely to do? To date him, okay? So she dates him. Saturday night, she goes out. And as they're driving down the street, down Ham Boulevard, Edward Street, they get pulled over by a police officer because the taillight's out. As the police officer comes walking up to the driver's side, the boy says to the girl, quick, get my driver's license, my registration out of the glove box. So she opens the glove box. It's dark in there, and something falls out in her lap on the floor. Things falling out. She don't know what they are. She picks one up, and as she rises one up to her face, the police officer leans in the window with the flashlight and sees her holding up a bag of marijuana or some white powder. And on her lap are more bags, and at her feet are more bags. And the police officer now feels that he is looking at drug dealing situation. Who gets arrested in the car? They both do. Okay, she gets arrested Saturday night. When does she get out? Monday? We live in a new day and age in the Department of Corrections in the state of California. You notice what do police cars have right on the hood? They have a camera. It's documenting everything. Before the cameras, the police officer can go, you know, maybe you're not such a bad kid. I'll give you a warning, drop you off. No, it's been documented now. And when it gets documented, they're worried about liability and everything else. And Child Protective Services get involved because you got a minor involved with drugs and possibly drug dealing. So let's realize right now that only if she is extremely lucky is she getting out on Monday. Now, in the lockup, you try to keep the kids not, you know, the violent ones away from the others, but, you know, they're overcrowded. You know that our prison system is at over 200% in California, occupancy, over 200%? So, this girl, maybe she's fairly good looking, has nice clothes on, recently got her hair styled, is sitting in a corner and crying, and looking at her with a lot of jealousy, because this girl looks pretty nice. Is a gang member who's been beat up. Remember the violence level's highest where in the Department of Corrections? In the girls' lockups. So she's been beat up, she's been in fights, and she's not real pretty. And she looks over this girl who's crying about the fact that she's gonna be in the lockup for days, and the gang member's gonna be there for months or years. Does the gang member want to go comfort this little girl? Does she want to hurt her? When mom and dad get their daughter back, is it the same daughter? Is it the same mom and dad? This is not a hypothetical story. I work with youth lockups. I work with the California Department of Corrections. Our children are getting arrested like never before. And the fastest growing part of our lockup is teenage girls, the fastest growing part. And we need to get involved, because if we don't, who will? Now, two last questions on this subject. Did the girl break the law? No. Whose fault is it she got arrested? The boys and hers too, because she got warned. Mom tried to tell her. I can't tell you how many kids I know of that are getting arrested. How many Seventh-day Adventist children have been incarcerated? I can't begin to tell you what's going on. Pastor sons that I've met in the lockup. We are a family, and nobody can do it alone. Even if you're a pastor or pastor's family, we can't do it alone. We need the church. We need each other. I want to share something really important. That's why I brought the fireman's helmet. When I was in prison, when I got moved from the prison, Terminal Island Federal Prison, isn't that a name? Terminal Island Prison? When I left there for Boron prison camp, the manager who's in charge of inmate rehabilitation had my file. And he said, hey, inmate, says here that you were a model inmate at Terminal Island. He says, to me, it just means you didn't get caught, because you're always up to something. This is the guy in charge of rehabilitation. He said, because you didn't get caught, I'll let you pick your job. You want to be a dishwasher or a plumber? I said, sir, what I'd like to be is an inmate fireman. You see, I know you have a fire department here. And he says, wait, just shut up. He said, the fire department is the honor position. You're not part of the honor club here. You're either gonna be a plumber or a dishwasher. What do you wanna be? I said, sir, if you're asking, I can only say fireman. He said, I knew it, you're a troublemaker and you're a plumber, get out of my office. So I went to the safety officer and I said, sir, I know I don't deserve it. I know I haven't earned it. But more than anything else, I want to be an inmate fireman, because it'll give me the chance to save lives and to do something good, to put on the uniform of a hero as an inmate will change my life like I can't believe. So I'll make you a promise. You give me a chance as an inmate fireman and you will never regret it. I'll be the first one here every morning. I'll be the last one to leave. I'll polish that truck. I'll repair that truck. I'll learn all I can about firefighting. I'll be the first one into a fire. I'll be the last one out. If you need somebody backing you up, I'll be there. But if you need somebody in front of you, I'll be there too. I'll get along with everybody here. I will be the best fireman you ever had. Please give me a chance to do something good with my life. You will not regret it. 1 week later, I was an inmate fireman. 3 months later, I was chief engineer of Boron Engine Company 52, an inmate fire crew at the Mojave Desert. We didn't fight brush fires. We responded to automobile accidents mostly. People coming back from Mammoth crashing their cars at night. For first aid, I had a cardiovascular and orthopedic surgeon. For my number one hoseman was a bank robber. My number two hoseman was a banker. They were buddies. Okay? You know what it was like to leave a prison? To hear the fire siren go, to run down to the fire truck, to grab the radio and key it on. San Bernardino Command, Inmate Engine Company 52, standing by. Roger 52, automobile accident with injuries, Kramer Junction, respond code 3, red light and siren. Wow, to pull out the fire truck, the men hanging on the back and on the sides, one and a guard riding next to me, to head for the prison gate and bring on the red light, and see the guard come running out and open up the gate and go, 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 and then to hit the siren and go down that highway, slightly breaking the speed limit with all the thrill of a prison escape, and you're going to save lives. We had a plane crash. A plane goes down in the Mojave Desert, 6 miles from our camp. A plane. They call us, respond, code 3. They don't know what kind of plane it was. I didn't know what kind of plane it was. Responded with 4 vehicles. It was out in open, rugged desert terrain. I lost 3 vehicles. Finally, it's just me with my fire crew, all of them on the fire truck because we lost 3 other vehicles. I'm driving a full-size fire truck across the open, rugged desert terrain like it's an off-road vehicle. We come over a little rise, and I see a great big silver capsule with parachutes draped on and a fire heading right from it. It was the B-1 bomber. The most advanced aircraft in the American inventory crashed 6 miles from our camp. Inmates were the first ones on the scene. We rescued 2 crewmen. One was already dead. Inmates. Is that a miracle that I got to do this stuff as an inmate? When I got out of prison, oh, wait a minute, I got a little video for you. Am I going too long? Am I doing okay? All right, I got a little video for you. The Seventh-day Adventist Church, Dan Matthews, did a documentary on my story. I want to share with you the day I got out of prison. It's reenacted. Get ready for this. How much money do you think we had to make this documentary? Not much, right? It won 3 gold medals, 2 of them at the world's largest secular film festival. This is the day I got out of prison.
My brother was waiting for me just outside the gate with the Baja Bug. And for a moment, it seemed like none of it had happened. It was just like before. We were kids again, out on summer vacation, heading off to the beach. I know that the others had made their deals, copped their pleas, and paid their lawyers. And that would be between them and God. It didn't concern me anymore. It was graduation day, and that wasn't all. The boys had planned a little graduation surprise. It's funny where friends can be found. In 3 years, it hadn't rained much at Boron. But now, it felt like enough water to wash away everything that had happened before. The memories of Escalante, Stewart, Stretch, the betrayal of a best friend, the fear, and the recrimination. Those waters, those healing waters, drenched all that away. I was that little boy, standing in the spray from the garden hose, awakened from the daydream of diving and fish and what it would be like to be a real diver. The one thing that I didn't plan on was, well, sometimes you gotta be careful what you pray for.
And stop. Okay, I'm not done yet. When I left prison, 2 years later, I got hired by the Cousteau Society as their chief expedition diver. That meant I was in charge of the expeditions. I got to lead Jacques Cousteau's and Jean-Michel Cousteau's research vessels around the world. 5.5 years of diving with whales and dolphins and sharks. Now, I was an ex-felon. I was still on parole. The state of California had to remove me from parole so I can go travel with the Cousteau's. Now, do you hear the stories like that from people who go to get out of prison? Do they get their childhood dream? Well, get ready for an incredible part. I don't speak French. You should have heard the Frenchman when I reported on board. They kept pantomiming it and talking about it. It's incredible, huh? Look at the flag on the boat. It's a French flag. It's tricolor, oui, huh? And me, I am a Frenchman. And the crew, we are all Frenchmen. The flag, the French, the ship is French. But who's in charge? The American. And the idiot cannot even speak French. It's bizarre, huh? For 5.5 years, I went on an odyssey of adventure of diving with whales and dolphins and sharks, and then I quit that job to become a lay youth minister in this church. And I have had more adventure, more challenge, seen more miracles as a lay person in this church. Wow. And if God can do this with an ex-felon, what can he do with you? Okay, you're probably wondering why I got the helmet here. I asked a fire captain, I said, sir, we don't have radios, except for the one in the truck. What do I do if any of my men get stuck in a building? How will I know that they need help? He said, well, there's a thing they used to do back in the turn of the century in New York when they first started building the tall buildings. He said, if you get stuck, the last thing you'd ever remove is your helmet. So that's exactly what you do. You take off your helmet and you throw it through a window or a burning hole, and when it hits the street, any other fireman knows that if the helmet is here, it means the fireman is there and that the fireman is in a life-threatening situation. And he said, Steve, if you have to, you drive your fire truck into the side of the building to make a hole to get back one of yours. I was in New Hampshire 14 years ago. I was speaking at a camporee at a county park. Had about 100 people max. And after the church service, I went to the payphone and I called my wife Cindy to see how she was doing. And as I got her on the phone, I said, hi, honey. And she said, Stephen, shh. I said, honey. She said, Stephen, shh. Please, dear, shh. Your brother's dead. He came home, put a gun to his head, and he pulled the trigger, and he's dead. I lost it. I couldn't talk. I hung up the phone and fled. I went into the woods to pray, and it came upon me, this is my only sibling. My brother, my father, my mom threw him out, thankfully. This is my only sibling. When I came out of the woods, I came out with a commitment to stay with the kids. You see, the children minister to the youth minister, okay? I'm going to stay with the kids. I'll get home in time for the funeral. I'm going to stay with the kids. And as I come out, I walk past a payphone, not the one I called my brother from, but another payphone. And I couldn't help myself. It was ringing. I had to answer that payphone. And I picked it up and I said, hello? And an oddly familiar voice said, is Steve Arrington there? And I go, well, this is Steve Arrington. Who's this? And he said, Steve, is Charlie White. Now, at the time, Charlie was the pastor of the Paradise Seventh-day Adventist Church. He's now the pastor out at Camelback in Phoenix, Arizona. And he was calling to comfort me. And as I'm crying on the phone talking to my pastor, I suddenly feel hands on me. And I look around, and it's all the pathfinders and the parents. And one really big guy, bigger than you, leaned over everybody, and he put a hand right on top of my head, and he squeezed so hard it hurt. And I loved that hand. When I got home, I went to see Charlie White. And I said, Charlie, how'd you get the phone number of that payphone? And he said, Steve, I don't know. I have no memory. I said, no, Charlie, wait, this is important. My brother committed suicide on a Thursday. My wife didn't know where I was at. It wasn't until I called her on Saturday at 12:30 that she was able to tell me, but I hung up the phone on her and didn't tell her where I was at. How'd you get that payphone number? He said, Steve, I have no memory. But as a pastor, I do know a divine appointment when one happens. When I needed God, he was there for me. When I needed my pastor, he was there for me. When I needed my church family, he was there for me. When I needed my family, they were there for me. On Sunday, I spoke at a Baptist church. And Saturday night, I did an evening program, just like I'm going to do here. And as I'm doing the program in the evening, I'm showing dolphins. I'm standing in the back of the church by the foyer. A girl comes up to me, maybe 14 years old. And she says, Mr. Arrington, I'm sorry about your brother. I said, it's okay. She said, no, we're not supposed to talk about it. I said, it's okay. She said, the pastor wasn't here today. I said, yeah, I know that. She says, not supposed to talk about that either. And I said, talk about what? She says, you know why the pastor wasn't here? And I said, no. She said, because his son committed suicide on Monday. We buried him on Friday. She said, when I came home, I was so crushed that I tried to take my own life, but I didn't have the courage. And I'm not supposed to be talking about this. She said, what am I supposed to do? And she leaned into my chest and she started to cry, which caught the attention of all the women in the back of the church, and everything stopped and they gathered around this girl. You see, she's in tragedy and she's not supposed to talk about it. 24 children approximately will commit suicide today. Over 500 will attempt it. Over 500 will attempt it. And they're not talking about it, or if they are talking about it, people aren't listening. You see, if they were firemen, at least they'd have a fire helmet to throw out to say, I'm in trouble. But they don't have that. And if they don't have a family that cares, 82% of the kids in America wind up in a single-parent household, who are they going to talk to? And if they're dropping out of school, and if they're falling out of society, and they're falling between the cracks, who's going to make a difference in their lives? Well, I told you what Jesus had to say about the 100 sheep and about the millstone. And we know what Jesus says in Matthew 18:3, that lest you be like a little child, innocent, you won't enter the kingdom of heaven. Well, Matthew 25:31-46 is the separation of sheep. And brothers and sisters, if we Christians are not clothing the naked, visiting those who are locked up, and feeding the hungry, the punishment for we Christians, and this is written in red, is greater, far greater than a millstone around the neck. We have a mandate. Grandparents, be in contact with your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren. Write them, call them, visit them, let them know that you care. As you can, get into the lockups, particularly for the women and for the children, and be involved. Get involved with the public school because the kids are dropping out. If we don't do something, who will? And because of the financial climate of California today and the nation, it's going to get worse, which is greater opportunities for us. Now, I've been heavy this morning, but we're at war, brothers and sisters. You are soldiers and you are on the front lines, and every single one of you is needed and have been divinely appointed by God to do the work. So we got to get busy. Tonight at 3:55 sharp, you're going to see my happy, friendly side, okay? I promise you a completely family program. I'm going to show you miracles tonight. If you have a friend, bring them. Also, please be prepared for an offering. There's no charge for the church for me to be here. Now, when I say that, I was up in Washington State, well, Portland last Sabbath. Before that, I was up in Washington. Next month, I'll be out in Atlanta, Georgia. I don't charge. I just do the work. And on Sabbath evening, I take an offering for the Dream Machine Foundation for the work that we're doing in Fiji. But brothers and sisters, I end with this thought. Before we, please get ready for Great is His faithfulness, number 100, open up your hymnals. Okay, remember this thought. If God can turn a felon into a Christian warrior, oh my, what He can do with you.